All right. So, hey, guess what? It's time again for the Lean Into Artcast, a weekly show where a couple of visual storytellers, interactive storytellers, get together and take a mental walk around some challenging questions, usually a big fat topic in the middle, and then we close out with some takeaways from our art week. My name is Jerzy Drozd, and that guy over there is...
I'm Rob Stenzinger. Hey, again. I don't know. Just coming out naturally, just rolling with it.
So, good to see you again, Rob.
Yeah, oh, good to see you. What a bunch of adventures since we last met.
Yep, I am married again, and had to relocate to another country.
You took on a whole new identity.
Oh, I don't have any disguises that I could put on. I got a Greedo mask in the closet. If I really wanted to, I could get up and put it on. But, you know, skipping past any, meager attempts at hawking around, joking around, we got warm up. Bypassing curveball at the top of this one. But I'm sure we'll find some curveballs in here.
Sure.
We're going to call this one warm up this week. Spend a few minutes talking about, because I'm sure people are wondering about that Small Press Expo thing that I went to last weekend. And that is going to figure into our larger topic today, which is going to be about conventioning from a UI, UX perspective. And I'm sure you will have plenty to say about that, Rob.
But as will you.
So lay it on me, bro. What do you want to know about what happened with the Small Press Expo?
Okay, so SPX sounds like essentially comics, indie comics Shangri-La, yes?
Everybody keeps calling it Comics Camp. Now, people who follow along with stuff that I do, just before this recording was being made after the fact, I did an episode of the Comics Are Great show, and that's going to be at comicsaregreat.com/CAG64 if you really want to go back and listen to it. We did some talking about the Small Press Expo with Sally Carson of Fixpert.com and Chad Sell of ChadSellComics.com. And we shared our reflections and experiences being at SPX, and they talked about how it's Comics Camp. You're going to Comics Camp. Why? Because the whole thing takes place in this one big hotel, but it's not too big. It's not like Comic-Con San Diego big, but it's big. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're in your room, and then you go down the elevator, and then you turn a corner, and there's the convention hall where you're tabling. So and then just one more floor down is where all the after parties happen, where everybody gets together and they drink, and there's like a chocolate fountain and a super art fight and the Ignatz Award show. But honest and for true, I after the first night, so like Saturday night after the show, everybody's feeling good because it's this really just positive place where the people who come to the show are interested in discovering new things. They're not there to pick up their latest branded merchandise from, you know, whatever big media companies. They're there looking for new stuff.
So you're talking about the – are you actually staying in this same sort of camp with both the artists and the constituents?
Yes, yeah.
Wow,
so,
okay.
Yeah, it has this really awesome vibe of you're all in the same boat. And I'm taking the elevator back up after Saturday – and I'm walking down the hallway to go to my room just to like kind of rest for a minute before going to the Ignatz Awards. And honest and for true, I'm walking by these hotel rooms and you just hear all of this cheering going on in all these different rooms. And I honestly heard coming from one of the rooms, SPX Comics, yay! Coming from one of the rooms.
That's awesome. Getting psyched up to run back down and get into it all.
It's really hard to describe without sounding silly, without sounding like a Christmas special or something, but that's how it felt.
So big events that have I don't know, when they have a feel of when everyone is on a similar page, I think that it seems like SPX may be achieving that, where, I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of a everyone gets to be immersed in a situation where they're not sharing this excitement alone anymore, and they get to, you know, it's kind of like any sort of enthusiast convention, right? But it seems like it's got a bit of a like a target. Even it's not like SPX and it's covering all these other bases, right? I mean, it's
That's a big one too. It is all about comics,
Right.
and I mean, you know, that's important to me. So, but I mean, like, even with the big names there, I mean, you had the Hernandez brothers, Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. You had, what is it, Chris Ware. You had Daniel Klaus. You had people who are well recognized names in comics, but they didn't. It didn't give off the vibe of being like, oh, Patrick Stewart's here, you know. I mean, nothing wrong with Patrick Stewart. I love Star Trek, but I mean, it's, you know, you get what I'm saying. He doesn't really have a whole lot to do with comics. He has to do
It's
with that
yeah, it's a
cult.
different ecosystem, really. I mean, you're talking about sort of a centrally managed distribution system of high investment, high risk products where sure, creative people with similar skills can get together and crank out things that involve these stars and big personalities, but it's a whole different system. And so typically you have that sort of separate groups, separate echelons within there, right? I mean, they have more hierarchy.
Sounds
like this was pretty flat. Like there was a lot of approachability across the board.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, and if you haven't been to a convention before, this may sound weird. Like, well, of course it would be flat, but at some shows there tends to be a bit of an echelon thing, right? Where you know, don't look them in the eye, don't talk to them unless they talk to you, kind of thing. And you know, they're the celebrity, right? But here it really had this vibe of everybody is on the same page. We're here to celebrate comics. And and this is where I have to take my hat off to SPX. I mean, as a guy who, you know, runs a convention himself, a festival, whatever you want to call Kids Read Comics, that is super important to me when I'm running my own show or co-running my own show. And I know how much work goes into developing a culture behind something, and how many debates and how much hand-wringing goes on, and like, is this beyond the scope of what we're trying to do here? 16 years they've been doing this thing, or at least 16 years they've been doing the Ignatz Awards, and I can't even imagine how much work went into developing that culture, but they've done it, and it's natural. And as a matter of fact, when the show concluded on Sunday, I saw this happen with my own eyes. The show ends at 6 o'clock on Sunday, right? Nobody came out to announce SPX is now closed. It was just like the moment the clock struck six, the room erupted into non-ironic applause. Like, not like, oh, thank God it's over, or like, oh, good job. Everybody was just like, woo! You know, it was completely spontaneous. It was so
Well,
weird. But that helps describe the vibe that you find there. It's really wild, just how upbeat, positive, and fun that event is. So, yeah, I had a marvelous time. It was one of the best weekends of my life.
so you're mentioning the you did a few different things at the at this event. I mean, obviously you had your tabling experience and you know, traveling to get there and all that, and you've got well, you were also MCing, right? The Ignatz Awards. I mean, I don't know, what was that like going from handling all those different things and wearing those different hats?
Well, can I start? I'll talk about the Ignatz Awards, but I want to start by saying one thing. And this should be, well, I'm gonna be all Rob about it, and I'm gonna see both sides of it. But at the same time, I'm looking at it from my side when I talk about this. If you have a friend, this is stupid helpy tip number one for today. If you have a friend who's going to do something that typically would stress people out, it might be a good idea to think of something to say to them beyond, "Hey, I heard you're doing a thing tonight. Are you nervous?" You know, because after the 20th person said that to me,
Heard you had that open wound. You need some more salt in that?
Now, the thing is like, yeah, I was a little nervous about hosting a show, but it wasn't because I thought I can't talk in front of people. I have plenty of experience doing that. That wasn't the issue. The issue was is that I have spoken in front of literally hundreds and hundreds of people at a go. I've spoken in front of 500 people in a room. I've been booed by 500 people. I've experienced the best and worst case scenarios. So that wasn't the issue. The issue was is that in all those other situations, most of the time I was talking to people who didn't really have a lot of experience with comics. I was selling them on comics. I have lots of experience doing that. Now I got to stand in front of my peers and figure out a story to tell as to why comics are so great from a, you know, a peer standpoint, and what's it got to do with this award show, right? That was the challenge. And the only nervousness I felt was, are they going to are they going to buy me, right? Are they going to accept the bill of goods that I've got on stage and my style of presentation? I know it works with other crowds, but I've never done it with this crowd. So that part was the only part that made me feel nervous. But even then I was like, well, you know, the worst – the Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost of Ryan Estrada popped over and said, hey, you know, that's worst awesome. Case scenario.
I want one of those.
He comes over, he says, worst case scenario, you bomb, and you got a great story to tell later on. And I was like, yeah, you know what? Ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi Ryan Estrada of RyanEstrada.com, you're right.
That is a world adventurer right there.
Yes, he is. And yeah, and every time that man opens his mouth, he leaves me with something where I'm like, oh, man, I got to think about that for the rest of my life now.
Life gives you a bridge. You just grab that bungee cord.
But so I wasn't terribly nervous, but after the 20th person was like, are you nervous? I was like, okay, well, I am now. Thank you, you know? And I know – here's why I get to be Rob. And like, I know that it's a situation where they're probably thinking, I would be nervous, and I'm sympathizing with you by saying, are you nervous? I would be. Therefore, I assume you would be. I'm sympathizing. I'm empathizing with you. I'm feeling your emotions. So that's a good thing.
Well – yeah, more like I'm projecting my emotions on you. You're nervous, aren't you? Aren't you nervous yet? You're going to fall down, aren't you?
So, okay, three people out of all the people I talked to said the right thing to me. And I'm going to share these not to call anybody out. I won't name the people who said these things to me. But three people said the thing that I thought was the most useful to me in preparing to go up on stage and talk in front of a whole bunch of people. And this is – so next time when you find yourself in the situation where you're talking to a friend who has to do something that might be kind of nerve-wracking, this is the thing you say to them. So one, I was talking to somebody and I said, you know, well, I'm fully prepared to bomb. And if I bomb, I promise I'm going to bomb big because, you know, I want it to be memorable. I'm going to get – and the joke I was telling all weekend long was like, I'm gonna bomb so bad that the Hernandez brothers beat me up on stage. You know, then at least you'll have something people talk about for ages, you know. Hey, remember the time when that – idiot got beat up by the Hernandez brothers. But then this guy says to me, he's like, yeah, but that time you got booed by those 500 people, you weren't talking about comics. You were talking about libraries. It's like, when you talk about comics, you don't screw up. So you're going to be fine. Mm. And whether or not – I know I've screwed up talking about comics before, but that was a nice thing to hear. And it was like sort of like a vote of confidence, you know? I was like, yeah, you got this thing licked. Another person who wasn't there texted me. And just said, I wish I could be there. I'm rooting for you. You know? Simple. I'm rooting for you. I wish I could see you do this thing that's cool, and I'm behind you 100% of the way. That's a nice thing to hear. And then my response was, I can't fail now. And then the third person that said something nice just said, like, I turned to him and I said, like, well, what do you think? And they said, what? You do this every day. You never shut up about comics. You got this thing locked. You know? Again, vote of confidence. Yeah. So that's what somebody needs to hear before they go walk onto a stage or doing anything that causes most people anxiety is, you got this thing locked. Don't worry about it. The short version of – there's going to be a video. They videotaped the thing. So it's going to be posted on the SPX site eventually so you can watch it for yourself. But
oh, awesome. We'll have to link to it for sure when we get a chance to do that.
Oh, yeah. And it wound up being a really nice, tight show. All the presenters – all I did – that's the other thing is like nobody remembers the host anyway. And I'm not denigrating myself. I'm just saying like when you remember award shows, you're not like, oh, that Billy Crystal. You know, you remember all the presenters who did funny things. I had no inflated sense of what this meant for me as a personality or any of that kind of thing, things like that. But – the presenters did an amazing job. I couldn't have asked for a better group of people to go up and keep a nice, tight, and funny show. Chris Hastings of DrMcNinja.com just stole it because he did this great Bob Newhart impersonation, and then David Malky did this fake thing where he was yelling at him from the crowd and then ran up onto the stage and started. They got into this philosophical debate about the nature of awards, but they kept it tight. It was only about a minute long, so then they could just get to the awards, you know? You know, everybody in Nick Abadzis went up to the stage and, you know, he just said, you know, well, we British people don't understand your American humor, so I'm going to read all the nominees in the hilarious British accent. And then he just did a whole bunch of different kinds of British accents as he read the nominees, and that was pretty funny. So it was just nice.
Exactly.
And tight.
But I know you Americans think our manners of speech are entertaining. That's really cool, though. And honestly, I have to admit, I do enjoy accents. I mean, other accents that, you know, that's wonderful.
So yeah, in a way it was almost poking fun at us, but it was great. It was a super nice tight show. And you know, I've been doing this talk and stuff on audio and video for, I don't know how many years, 5 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I've been told by some people in the past that I can be funny sometimes, but you know what, when you're doing this kind of time shifted stuff, you never know. You know, when somebody writes LOL in a chat client, are they really laughing out loud? I don't know. You know, I mean, I'll take it on good faith that they are, but, you know, it could just be like, ah, cute, LOL. I got to stand up in front of a group of people. I told some jokes, and I got to hear a whole room full of people laugh at my joke. That was pretty cool.
Oh, that rocks. What I want to know is, so were you thinking of doing more experiments with that live joke telling thing?
Oh, heck know. No.
No? Because, I mean, I have not I don't know if there's any video of it posted or whatnot, but I remember at some point Ryan Estrada mentioning that he does stand-up comedy.
Yeah, he does.
And I
remember saying
huge
something –
huge respect for that.
I remember saying something to the effect of, like, I wish I had your experience in doing stand-up, and Ryan – ah, oh, he's so awesome. He instead of like, you know, being like, oh, thanks, ain't nothing but a thing, he deflected my compliment by throwing a link at me to all of the open mic stand-ups in my area. He's like, yeah. He's like, no, you don't. You don't get to let yourself off the hook by saying I'm good at this and you're not. You do it too then. If you wish you had that talent, you go do it. You know, as only he could do, you know, so – yeah.
Now, wait a minute. So let's turn this to, like, turn that ethos onto SPX. I'm betting that. So what would SPX be like for someone who is just getting into, or maybe was starting to draw comics, or maybe even had like a mini in hand? That. Mm-hmm.
What would it be like for them?
Yeah. What would it be like for them?
It's the show where you could go to with a hand done mini. And you could approach a bunch of creators and engage them about their work. And even if you don't know them very well, just get them to start talking about their work. And they're happy to talk with you. And if you hit it off, they're more than happy to trade with you. But, I mean, we could go into an etiquette thing. I personally don't think you should lead with the trade. You know, you want to trade books? I don't know.
No, I wasn't necessarily assuming the trade angle. But, yeah, some people would have that motivation too. And that,
sure.
That's common as well.
But yeah, I did have people come up to the table who didn't know me. You know, they didn't know anything that I do, but they came up and they just started asking for advice. They're like, well, what do you do for a living? You know, I see you got comics here, but what do you do as a job? And I tell them. And they're like, well, how did you get into that? You know, and I told them more, you know, and then Casey Van Heiss of wintersandlavelle.com was right next to me. And so she started chiming in, you know. And so, yeah, you can walk up to people. You can say, how do you do this thing? And they'll tell you, and they'll give you resources to do that too. Or if you just want to talk about, is an Adventure Time cool? You can have that conversation as well. But it's a place for people who are enthusiastic about the medium of comics. Whether you are a practitioner or just somebody who enjoys the medium, you can have really fun and thoughtful discussions about the medium with a wide variety, ranging from, you know, people who are on the lower end of the famous spectrum like me, or if you want to talk to somebody like a Daniel Klaus about it, you know, if the line doesn't push you too hard, because he had a big line. but everybody was super, super, you know, upbeat and personable and approachable, you know. So
what what was something about the show that was the most surprising, that was not as anticipated going into it, even though you've been there before?
Yeah. I'm taking a thoughtful sip of my coffee for the folks who are listening into the audio after the fact while I consider this question. What was the most surprising thing? I guess probably the most surprising thing was And I think I stood in a good place because I hosted the Ignatz Awards, and so like it was easier for me to strike up conversations with people, because I was after that I was starting to get like, you know, people who I didn't know saying like, hey, good job last night, you know, that was a neat thing that you did, and that kind of thing. So it was easier to engage with people. Mm-hmm. Because believe it or not, I am, when I'm in public, I'm very reluctant to strike up a conversation with somebody I don't know. And I'll often, if I'm at a grouping, I'll listen to the conversation. This is something that Tim Street, I've mentioned this quote a million times. I listen to the conversation. If there's something I can contribute, I'll add. But for the most part, I don't instigate a lot of conversations. The biggest surprise for me was how connected I wound up feeling to everything as a result of, just talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the story. I was talking with my buddy Hoover the other day about this very thing. It reminded me of when I was 19 and I went to my very first convention, where I tabled at my first convention. And it was at the Motor City Comic Con. This was the 90s. It was at the height of that whole speculator boom and all the variant die-cut hollow foil covers, right? You remember that, Rob?
I do. Looking around to see if I have any in arm's reach.
And I go to the con and I get a table, and they had a sort of a break area for the artists to all go, and they had spread laid out. Now, in retrospect, I don't think the room was that awesome. I think it was just like sort of like an employee break area, you know, and I don't remember if the spread was all that good. But as a 19-year-old, this was all fresh to me, and I was like, oh, my God, there's a room in here where it's just cartoonists sitting and talking, and they got food. They got food laid out for me. This is amazing. And I'm sitting there, and I'm eating the sandwich, and right next to me is Brian Murray. Now, Brian Murray was working on Supreme at the time, one of the Liefeld books. Well, however you feel about Brian Murray, all I knew was I'm 19. I'm a kid just starting out with my stupid, you know, stapled hand-done minis, and this guy's working for Image, right? And I'm listening to him talk with his buddies, and they're just talking shop. They're talking like inside baseball stuff about different editors, different publishing houses, different things that are going on with – they weren't talking about what's your favorite movie. They weren't talking about politics. They weren't talking about any kind of football game. All they were talking about was like the inside baseball of comics. And I sat there with just my – you know, no eyelids watching. I'm like, oh, my gosh. That's going to be me someday. I want to be in on those conversations. I'm going to be talking with these guys about this kind of trade stuff. And all it took was 20 years.
That's all.
No. But I mean, that's how it felt to me. It felt like that I was in on those conversations at the show, but not because of any kind of privileged place that I was holding, but because people were so approachable that you could just strike up those conversations with everybody there. And I was thinking about how different it would have been had I – because like when I was 19 in the 90s, there was a really clear hierarchy of like here's Garib Sheamus's Wizard Magazine top 10 artists, you know, wait in line for 45 minutes to get something signed by them, and they're not going to talk to you, versus something like SPX, where everybody's a human being. And I'm seeing these 19-year-old kids walking around talking to these artists, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, how profound that must be for those people to have that kind of rich experience interacting with somebody that they admire, you know, and be able to interact with them on that level. So that would be, I'd say, the biggest surprise, not surprised by SPX, but surprised that we've come that far, that things have changed that much, and that, as dumb as it sounds, courageous people like the folks who organize SPX put that together and had that vision, you know, that's awesome.
That is super cool. It sounds like a fantastic show, and I'm completely sad that I didn't go.
No, yeah. You have to go next year.
Yeah, I got to go next year. And then I'll get to find out what it's like for a comic artist who, you know, has chipped away at it for a few years and had some fits and starts. And
that's the crazy thing. Nobody asks you that. Nobody says, like, how long you been at this thing? What's your background? What's your training?
Sure.
How many books you have published? Nobody
what's
asked
your degree
that.
In?
Yeah. Nobody says that. I mean, like some people were trading with me. They're like handing me like 200-page trade paperbacks, and I'm like, oh, dude, all I brought was my silly little Cap'n Cat mini comic. And they're like, yeah, but Cap'n Cat's awesome, so I want to trade. And I'm like, okay, you know, and not to say like, oh, hey, you can get really awesome deals on trading. What I'm pointing at is the attitude of they're not judging on what your pedigree is. They're judging, is it good? Is it good, and are you interesting? Right. It's like that whole thing that people have talked about the internet for the last 5 years. It's like it's this great leveling agent to say that now we all have an equal chance, and the only thing that's stopping you is, are you trying? Are you interesting? Are you helpful? And are you good? And even if you're not good, as long as you got one of those three, you know, you're in good shape.
Well, yeah, it is very interesting. So there's two things that now I'm curious about, and I think it's worth tying in there. Like, so you mentioned the sort of the equalizing factor of that kind of culture, and I do think that's something that's come out of the last. Well, I mean, it's existed for, you know, for forever, but I think we've had some dominant forces as far as a centralized media culture in the last roughly 100 years or so, right? And I think we're now getting more plural. We're having coexistence of different kinds of cultures and exchange as far as, you know, direct connections with people who make things, and that's okay. We're not having to follow some kind of central media mythology that, oh, you're an artist. That's always what you do. You're a cog in this factory and what have you, and you will only be looked at as that because that's your brand or whatever. And you get, I think that's interesting. It reminds me of something early on in the internet when I was drinking all the Kool-Aid I could, as far as how did the internet come about? And this is interesting. And maybe this is where I'll make my money now, is, you know, helping people do stuff with it. But I remember a presentation that I've been hunting for and I cannot find. But I know I didn't dream it, but it was put on by someone who used to work at Xerox PARC and something related to that. And the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, they're one of the places where a lot of our modern computing ideas came from. Not the only place, and there's a lot of different people working on these things simultaneously and different people taking credit for the same thing. But they did a lot of cool stuff nonetheless. They had this kind of this slide that's really cheeseball, but I want to find it because it's a great ethos, is that and it rhymes. They were saying that, so now you're in this situation where you can have a presence in the world that everyone else can see. When did that ever exist before? And they said, you cannot tell the towers from the flowers. And so they're, they practically then went, peace, dude. But but it's a neat idea.
Yeah, is a neat idea. You know, we shouldn't, I don't know if we should or shouldn't, but sometimes I regret shying away from being that way. You know, part of me, I opened up my Ignatz talk by saying, you know, it is a great honor to be up here, but really, I'm just glad to help out. You know, and I know it's dumb and corny, and it's an appropriated quote from He-Man. I didn't attribute it though because I thought, oh, that's the best way to get booed off the stage. But I meant it. I meant it. You know, it's like, this is really cool. But you know what really feels better than being up here is just knowing that I'm contributing in some way. That's the cool part.
That's another super interesting thing about what you described in your story is honestly, it sounds like you've been going through that experience of connecting with people who are less interested about differentiating in that hierarchical sense and more what value can you bring to our group or what have you. And for someone who, obviously, we don't have to go through your capabilities in public presentation and selling and whatnot. I think you're really good at that stuff, but you're not necessarily going to be like a hardcore salesperson making all, you know, grabbing all the hands to shake and using more, techniques that that extremely outgoing people would use to connect with a tribe, right? So what a perfect chance to connect with a tribe in mass, but then to provide a good service to them that happens to be an in-mass service, right?
That was the part that was exciting, right? It's nice to do what you do naturally and have it actually kind of be useful to somebody without having to make a big hard sell about it. No, you're absolutely right. And that's something we talked about in the Comics Are Great episode that I referred to earlier, is we talked about, you know, the difference between tabling with dignity and tabling like a salesperson. Mm. And I think that's as good of a segue as we can come up with, or I can come up with anyway, as we head on over to the main topic. 1,000 feet up as the SDF-1 ascends before its anti-grav boosters fail and it falls back to the ground. Hopefully that won't happen to us, though, Rob.
Man, I hope not. Commander Glovel will be mighty stressed.
He'll say, "Boji moi." So, one of the things that came out of the post-SPX discussions and when I had Sally Carson of Fixpert.com, Fixpert on the Twitters, on the show, is I just casually asked her, like, do you think about tabling any differently? Because she has a background in UI UX design. And, you know, it's just possible that you and I have broached this topic before on the show, but at this point, I've done so many darn shows. And plus,
I've got so many families in so many states. That's why I name my kids all the same.
They're all Jersey.
We're all Jersey Junior.
Even the girls. So it's possible we broached this before, but like when she started dropping some of this smart stuff my way, I was like, ding, 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 ding. I got to ask Rob about this. I got to get Rob to extrapolate, elaborate, and refine these ideas because it was, you know, okay, I'm gonna try to frame this, preface this by saying this. Conventioning, it is an old topic. It has been discussed endlessly. I myself have been a part of many, many discussions on conventioning. And as a matter of fact, I need to make a note to refer to an old Art and Story episode where I put together an actual spreadsheet of how much it costs to go to a typical convention. I think that'd be a good resource to this day.
Definitely.
But anyway, so yeah. Lots of people have talked about this, and often, and I'm guilty of this myself, often the discussion devolves into, oh, what's the right way to engage with people? Well, you should smile a lot. You should make a lot of eye contact. Don't just sketch to the table. No, I like the sketch of the table. You should have your displays high. No, you should have your displays low. Lots and lots of advice gets kicked around like this, and as I was coming back from SPX, I was like, I got to find the story for this. I got to find the story. I want to talk about my convention experience, and I want to make it a useful topic. But what's the angle? What's the way this hasn't been talked about yet? And when Sally said that thing, I was like, dang, I got this guy. I got this big, giant pot of leprechaun gold sitting next to me named Rob Stenzinger where I can go, hey, Rob, UI UX design, how does that figure into this? Because when you're going to a show, you want something to happen, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't go to it. You wouldn't pay $1,000 to attend a show. $1,000 meaning $300 for your table, $500 for your hotel, $200 for your travel expenses. Quickly adds up to a grand. Easy.
Easy.
So you would not do this unless you wanted something, whether you want sales, whether you want camaraderie, interaction with others, whether you want to perform a service for others. You keep using this word service. So, Rob.
I do. Yeah, sorry. I do come back. For me, the service, the two sides of that coin – that aren't necessarily binary to one another, but you have service and expression, something that we've gone through kind of thematically in the show, partially because I'm repetitive, but also because, you know, we explored it in the design series as well.
That's right. We need to add that to the show notes as well, because I think we're going to talk about design quite a bit.
Yeah. What you're describing is that – so you don't have to enter into this with those kind of assumptions, but then you're going to be more reacting to the things around you versus observing and acting and trying to find a way to fit harmoniously with what you want to have happen, with what you're providing and how things work, like how big is the table what's your audience interested in and all that kind of stuff. If you're not thinking about that, then you'll be tossed. It's like saying, I don't care about the weather. And what's funny is I'm not someone who plans ahead for the weather, really. I'm a stick my head out the window person. But I will go grab an umbrella. So I would say it's a bit like saying, I don't care about the weather and I'm going to run outside no matter what time of year, what the temperature, what the conditions are. I'm just going to wear, you know, high 80 shorts.
Yeah. Those ones with the white piping on them?
Yep, with the piping. So at some point you'll be just tossed around by the conditions versus trying to connect with them.
Yep. And I want to preemptively take this one in the head is, you know, we're attempting to manipulate human behavior when we go to a convention, right? I mean, that's implicit in there. And somebody's gonna say, oh, manipulative, that's terrible. But as Rob has said in past episodes, and I am 100% behind this statement, all art is manipulative. If we're trying to express something, we're trying to affect somebody, we're trying to manipulate them in some way, not in a bad way. You know, when somebody – when you watch The Iron Giant and when he's flying up at the end of that movie and he says Superman, that is a storyteller manipulating you. And you don't regret it. You enjoy it every time, you know, so –
Yeah, exactly. It's and I think a lot of artists have that. It's worth acknowledging that dissonant factor of that we, you know, you get into or you probably would notice intense conversations about art being, you know, people selling out and focusing too much on some business aspect of their art or needing to focus more on it, and people advocating all these the different sides of it, and this isn't we're not going to present it in a binary way. Like, sure, I have the bias of saying, well, you know, I look at it as, why are you doing this one, right? And then if you're just doing it truly to do some self-expression, awesome. But what's funny is, like, maybe it doesn't end there. If it ends there, then it's sand art and you let it blow away and whatever. But if all of a sudden you're carrying it with you to a convention and you spent money on printing them, then maybe you're going past the phase of the self-expression. You're hunting to see if does this thing you made, does this product have an audience?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, especially in a society where we don't occupy every role and every need in our lives on our own. We don't all live in self-sustaining farms and stuff, right? We have to engage in trade. It's part of how part of how we organize as a society. And I can see that there's great and frustrating examples. I would bet that we could probably name. I don't know if it's worth it, but imagine
I don't think we need to make this case any further. I think that you've made a very eloquent case for the fact that, yeah, if you're going to conventions, you want to engage in some form of trade, whether that trade is monetary, whether it is cultural trade, getting to meet your peers and getting to engage and interact with them and feel connected to some kind of culture, or if it is to simply delight an audience where you're not hoping to get money, but you want to make people happy, right? That's a form of trade as well. So with that said, one of the things that you've talked about in the past that, man, again, once Sally said those words, it was just like 50 lights just lit up in my head. It was like, Rob said this, 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 and this, and this. And it all ties in directly to what we're just supposed to be doing at conventions. Defining goals. You know, you talk about when you're doing usability testing, you're trying to figure out who is using this thing. How are they using this thing? Are they clicking the thing I want them to click? You know, some of the things you've talked about in the past, like what are they called? Heat maps? Is that what they're called?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of ways where you can start to measure and observe what's going on in your situation. So with a website, you have certain tools. With a convention, you have certain tools. And you can do some things on a website because it's software. You know, there's a lot of things you can automate that will help you out. And so like a heat map would be about trying to discern where are people looking, right? And the official way to get a heat map is you actually have eye tracking cameras. So you may have two cameras or one camera with a really fancy algorithm figuring out what people's eyes are looking at and correlating it to what's being displayed on the screen at the moment. And then what they look at the most shows up as a hot spot, like, and it draws your attention.
The Predator's visor, like the infrared visor that the Predator uses, right?
Exactly. As if the elements that you put on your page are able to emanate heat, and they look tasty to a predator.
Now, you can't do this at your table, obviously. You can't put up eye tracking cam. Well, maybe you could if you're really sneaky.
I would bet if you are going to school at, like, I don't know, perhaps a department who focuses on usability, you might have a good chance at pulling that off.
But the fact of the matter is that, you know, most of us don't have access to that kind of technology. So that's the kind of thing where we just have to be observant. What are people looking at first?
Exactly. And you can think, well, were they touching? What evidence gets left behind? People disturb things on your table, right? Stuff, yep. You put it in a certain way. If you're forgetful or busy, take a picture of it. And you'll be able to detect later on what happened, what something changed. And it's worth wondering, well, why did that change? When did that change?
Right.
That kind of thing.
One of the things that I noticed over the course of the weekend, this is where I did some A/B testing, which we can talk about maybe a little bit more in a second, is so I had this book on the table. There it is, like leaning out facing the crowd. And I noticed people would walk by and they would see the cover and they'd read Captain Cat, former shark hunter, and they'd smile. They'd be like, oh, but they wouldn't crack it open. Sometimes they'd pick it up and they kind of look at the cover for a second and put it back down. And I realized, if you guys, you know, you're being betrayed, or rather the book is being betrayed by having such a simple cover. If people were to look inside and see that magnificent two-page spread that I showed off in a past episode, then they'd say, you know, there's more to it than that simple image.
Right.
So I opened up the book and I set it down in front of the stand with those books. And boom, almost instantly I noticed people would stop, look at the book, pick it up, and start to flip through it. Then take the book out and maybe consider buying it. And sales, what I should have done is I was tracking my sales, but I wasn't tracking what time they were happening. That's what I should have done. What I should have done is okay, 2 o'clock, I changed this on the table. See how sales changed as a result of that. Shame on me. But I did, you know, anecdotally, I did notice that there was a more of an uptake in participation with the work on the table as a result of doing that simple thing.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to have perfect data to make good decisions still.
Right.
You can have, you know, some sketchy, you know, close enough data where, yeah, I mean, the contrast in the results that was occurring was clear enough that, oh, okay. And honestly, so yeah, you actually formed a hypothesis like, oh, okay, this, the cover of this book isn't quite doing the contents justice in this situation, because that initial reaction that people are having is positive, but it's not closing a sale.
Right.
And so, okay, maybe you're feeling joy from making people smile who are walking by, but your wallet's not getting larger. If that's part of how you're judging your success, then, well, there right. You go. Okay, time to take this to test this theory, right?
Yep. So, yeah,
that process, though, right there. I'm sorry to interrupt. Like that's the key little nugget right there. It's a certain intentionality for you have a goal, and you know you notice data going a certain way or not. Where are you progressing toward the goal? Well, at all, or well enough, and then come up with adjustments. And test them out.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's doing shows for a long time has sort of like made me intuit those kinds of things. Or maybe I was just, you know, looking for something to do. But because I don't want to profess to have like a highly scientific mind or anything. But and you know, probably has a little bit to do with talking to you as well for so long now that it's becoming an intuitive act. But the thing that I felt like as I was driving home that I felt like, you know, I didn't have a strong grasp of is I didn't clearly define my goals in going down there. Now, what I did do is I printed a buttload of Captain Cat comics because I thought this has a really good hook to it. It has it's simple, high concept idea. It's got an image of a cat in people clothes. How can this lose? I'm also proud of the story. I think it turned out really good. I posted it online today, actually, on Google Plus. You can read it in its entirety for free, but then I put 20 copies on Etsy for sale. And I sold more of them than I've sold any other book that I've ever taken to shows. But I had it in my head that, okay, I need to make a lot of these because I suspect that this is going to do well. but I didn't make any kind of concrete goal of I'm going to sell X amount, right? And I also didn't prioritize what my goals were. I was like, okay, what am I really after here? I'm after connection to a culture. I'm after providing a service to that culture because I was invited to, but I'm happy to do it. And then I'm after, you know, selling a lot of books, not to make X amount of money, but to get my works into the hands of lots of people. So with that in mind, that was the only clear goal that I set out with, where I said, you know what, I'm not taking the front this year. I'm not taking my high-end items. All I'm taking is minis this year, because it's not about coming back with a bunch of money. It's more about spreading awareness, using this opportunity of performing the service for these people to possibly spread more awareness about my work itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, I thought, well, let's just make everything low price items this time. A lot of like impulse buys, where or things that I wouldn't feel financially pained by trading. You know, it's like a buck or buck and a half or something to make a Cap'n Cat book. So it's not a huge deal to trade it for something else. Whereas $6 a unit for a copy of the front, I'm a little bit less eager to trade that with the people. So anyway, but I didn't sit down and say, okay, what's my top goal? And what actions can I begin to take toward that goal, and then start hypothesizing on the fly while I'm doing it in order to adjust for that goal? But that's the thing that I think in future events I'm going to be thinking really hard about, is coming up with a – let's come up with a structure. Let's come up with a hierarchy of what are the four things I'm after, and in what order, so I know when to prioritize these different behaviors and actions.
And what you mentioned, I mean, it even when you're doing this, especially anything that – if you're not building it in some kind of automated software system, I mean, there's always going to be this – the chaos of things happening as they happen, right? That I think it's just you're better prepared to have it go in a – you're more likely to have it go in a direction that you're setting out to do, or – more ready to try another scenario because you're just used to playing around with it in that way.
Mm-hmm. But at least you know when you're playing around with it, you know why you're playing around with it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's okay to make money at your art. In fact, it's really important.
I wasn't trying to play that down.
No. And I'm saying that I'm hammering – I'm being heavy-handed guy.
You're being explicit.
Yep.
But yeah, just so that I could be a little explicit too, is like I wasn't saying that money wasn't a priority because I'm oh so wealthy. I, you know, one of my takeaways for this week's show comes out of the fact that I didn't have a lot of money on hand at this show, and I paid the price in a different way. But given the time considerations that I was under, and given what I originally intended to do at SPX before I got invited to do the Ignatz Awards, It became necessary to make it a lower priority and to work with what I had and define my goals based on what my resources were. If that doesn't sound abstract enough.
It sounds a lot like someone who is dealing with the trade-offs of running a business.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to broach is that when you're designing software, products, games, websites, mm-hmm. you're also – and gosh, this is something we've talked about off the air so much – what services do you hope to provide at this show? If it's not sales, or if sales is only part of a larger picture that you're trying to achieve, what's the service you're trying to provide? I'm wondering, Rob, if you could draw any parallels between, you know, the usability testing and the site designs and the product designs you've done in the past, and the services that these products are attempting to achieve, with what services an artist might be providing behind a table. Because somebody's going to say, like, well, what do you mean? I'm here to sell stuff. What do you mean services?
Mm. Well, let's see. So your comic or the thing you're selling, the buttons, the whatever you've crafted something, and it is it's meant to be an object to be appreciated or have to show some kind of symbolic, some importance. Something. It's meant to mean something, right? Which mm-hmm. means that, and if it's comic, I think it goes a little beyond that, because then it's a, there's, I guess what I'm starting to do is paint sort of a progression of the depth of the service you're providing. So you go from making an object that may perform a task or not, right? So one thing I sell is guitar picks, because guitar is a lot, is quite related to Art Geek Zoo, the way of sound. So that is meant to be an object to both, you know, provide a functional object that people can, whatever. So what you're doing has these qualities to it, right? So if you're like, well, it's a comic, you know, okay, well, it is a, what kind of comic is it? It's a paper comic. What genre is it? Who's it trying to entertain, right? Or is it for educational purposes? Like, gosh, I read through Poorcraft recently.
Oh yeah, yeah, Poorcraft by Diana Nock and Spike Trotman.
Yeah, and that's a very educational book. In fact, I mean, it's clear like that, like with a book with that much information in it is providing a different service. It's meant to be engaging, but it's less about the entertainment aspect of being engaging than to convey a lot of useful tips and information under an overall theme. So, and now you start, whereas you could have a, you know, a story that's meant to be entertaining or whatever, and then thinking about, okay, you've thought about your thing and you know what you're trying, what your audience may be trying to get out of it. Now step back and look at it from, try to step back and look at it from someone else's perspective, because you can never do this perfectly. Even someone who practices this day in and day out, you will never be that other person.
Right. Yeah.
But you can start to model and play around with the experience of approaching your thing not as you.
You're a visual storyteller, that's the currency you deal in, is being other people through your work, right?
Yeah.
So I mean that skill set is in you if you're making stories of any kind of merit. So you know, you're using your imagination on a regular basis. I would just say, you know, you pointed out rightly so that it's a difficult thing to do, but as I think about it, I'm kicking myself going, dude, your job is to imagine. Use your imagination to be somebody else for a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so you are essentially characterizing someone who may be coming to engage with that thing you made. And that thing you made does represent a service, and how you present it is the experience of that service. And as you start to take that external perspective on what you're doing, you can come up with interesting distinctions. Like, let's say you have that emanate from characterizing who you're trying to connect with. So if you are connecting with someone who is let's see, probably in like a younger audience, ages, I don't know, 3 to 3 to 4.5 or something, some stage of childhood development you're trying to target with your work, or, you know, 4 to 6 or 7 to 8, or, you know, it's pick a range.
Using it, that as a jumping off point, I got a great example. Mark Mariano of mypalmark.com. He is aiming for that 4 to 6 year old range, mm-hmm. where it's a story that the kids are meant to interact with. But at that age, at like the 4-year-old age, they want mom and dad to participate in it with them. You know, they're still at that age where they want mom and dad to be along for the ride. They're not getting to that independent age yet. And so he designed his books to have family activities following every story and family discussion points. Here's, okay, now that you finish the story, talk about it with your kids, mom and dad. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? How did this feel? How did that feel? Would you make the same decision as this guy? And then here's something you can all do together. And it's not just to make my character. Here's how to make a paper bag puppet out of my character. It's something based on that, something that happens in the story that now can be extrapolated into a family activity. Now, I, as a guy who's aiming at 10 to 12-year-old kids, that's not the best fit. So what I did is I made coloring pages, game pages, right? Solve the puzzle, solve the maze, something a kid can do on their own without mom and dad, but can still stay immersed in the world of the story through some kind of interactive feature, right?
Exactly. And what that can come from is it can come from an intuitive place because you're just naturally targeting something. It absolutely can. But even unboxing something from the intuitive place can help you extend it more easily
It
versus
can help
waiting
you,
for the next intuitive insight to occur.
and it can help you steer from going astray too, right? So, like when somebody said to me at a show years ago when I was doing the sugary cereal stuff with the anthologies, and they're like, "This is great. You got great characters. You got great stories here. This needs to be made into a game. Kids don't care about comics, but if you make a game out of this stuff, oh man, you're gonna get so much money." And that's not the service that I'm out to provide.
I
So.
love it how all of us can oversimplify each other's disciplines, and how much better it is when you do when you know or do blank.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's funny.
Yeah, because it would be just like snap my fingers and I could make a game, right? I mean, it's just that simple.
Totally.
I just hire some code monkey like you
I
to
just
do
made
it for
five
me.
games.
I made four games of the toilet this morning. Yeah, just bam, just they just keep coming. But yeah, and it's the same. Sorry, Rob. The same thing is like when people talk about comics, right? It's like, oh, this is a fun way to spend your time. What do you do for a real job?
That must be nice.
Yeah, that must be. You're such a fun guy to be around. But anyway, but yeah. So it was easy for me to know that. I mean, although I was, when I first heard that, I was like, should I do a game? And then I thought, I don't know the first thing about it. I don't know who to contact. Let's okay. Before I start doing any research in that direction, let's evaluate what would this solve? What service would this provide? And unless I was going to go like $1 million kind of job of making a game where there's like real story to it, not just the side scroller was like, eat the watermelon. Doesn't really solve the situation that I'm trying or solve the problem that I'm trying to solve through my work or the service I'm trying to provide. I wanted to fit in some talk on design because Rob, I know this is a hot button topic for you, and I know that you spend a lot of time thinking about this. One of the things that Sally said to me on that Comics Are Great show that was just like a lightning bolt in my head was she was talking about how she even designed her cover from a UI UX standpoint of using the concept of high contrast colors. They tend to attract more attention. And then she even puts this high contrast color cover on another contrasting background in its stand. So, like, if you got a blue cover with like a predominance of blue, maybe a splashy yellow in the middle, so you got some good contrast. Now I'm going to put this on an orange stand, so there's even more contrast, and then eliminate the amount of contrast surrounding it, so that you have a focal point. And she's like, and then talking about my goal is my conversion goal is getting somebody to read the book and buy the book. Those are my two conversion goals, right? Get them to pick it up and read it and then buy it. So how do I design my table layout to get those conversions? And so she used some simple design principles thoughtfully. And you know what? Gosh darn it. This doesn't have a ton of contrast on it, As a matter of fact, there's white ink here that you probably can't see on the video, that's almost invisible. And when I first did it, I thought, oh, that's kind of neat. That's kind of elegant. It's got a nice texture to it and everything. So I did it like
It's
a dot
subtle,
pattern.
but it has an elegant aesthetic to it, though. I mean, so, but it depends on the audience, I would say, right? And you know what? I would bet that comic would sell to a I mean, I think it's a really awesome, sweet comic. I'm not trying to, do some
No.
weird joke about it, whatever, but
Be
I
as
could see
scientific
sort
as
of a
possible. What's that?
like a arts and crafts kind of show that has a little bit older demographic, right? They're not looking for the they're it's a little more thoughtful, that kind of cover. It's a little reserved. It's beautiful, right? But it's is it addressing that same kind of process of drawing someone's attention to something more than the art, but something versus the system surrounding it. So what I can hear from Sally Carson's approach is that she has a system surrounding presenting the product that she's sharing, right? So it's the visual, drawing someone's attention, and well, essentially, well, there's a process that's sales related that a lot of web design is based on too. It's called, I think, what's called ADA, or it gets extended or whatnot. It's like attention, interest, decision, and action, right? And you think about that's a process to have in mind, like what brings someone through these phases, which is like a conversion funnel, which I think you mentioned she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, think of it as the funhouse slide, right? So how do you get people to the trap door to fall down the slide? And your table is your funhouse. And anyway, and you don't want them to fall on a trap door, but you want their money to fall into anyway. yeah, enough of metaphor.
But again, you know, you're pointing out that these design principles are not a definitive, hard and fast objective thing. It depends on your audience. So it's about knowing who your users are, defining your users, defining your target audience, as they say, and then defining the goals that you want to achieve, and then using design principles to achieve those goals with the users you want to engage with, right?
Exactly. And you can break it down into, instead of like from step one to finish, you can use a system like ADA or what have you, the attention, the interest, the decision, and the action, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you and if you at each step along the phase, you could have helpful aspects or harmful aspects that bring people, that cause people to leave the conversion funnel, essentially. So, for instance, you could have the great attention, right? Nice visual contrast that shows the existence of your comic among a population of all these other things going on, and even, you know, bolstered by some quiet, some negative space, and then all of a sudden the symbol that will attract their interest, and now they're getting more attached to or processing, but they're engaged somehow, right? So you couldn't have gotten here without that initial step, right? Now that they're engaged somehow, and now they're picking it up and progressing toward decision. Okay, now how do they act upon it? And all of a sudden you make it really hard to pay for your comic, right? Boom,
right.
Lost them in the conversion funnel. And that's where it is a system, and it's worth thinking about all those different steps.
Yep.
And it's cool. It sounds like you covered a lot of awesome ground with Sally on this, and, you know.
Spend about 10 minutes on it, and I wanted to, you know, spend a little bit more time on it with you, because, I mean, maybe we're getting to the part where we can go on the ground and talk about some actual resources people can use to start applying.
Mm.
I mean, because, like, I'm going to go to the library tomorrow and I'll be like, hey, I need some books on UI, UX design.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm going to have, the best resources. I'd rather hear it from somebody who lives and breathes this stuff. What do you use? And with that, I'm going to say a few more words to Vamp until I can play the On the Ground theme.
Yep.
So,
gotta have my Veritech fighter take cover behind this partially fallen building to avoid the Zentradi attack.
Because Chiron's over there and he's mad again.
He's got a big ego.
So, practical stuff. Okay, we talked about a lot of theoretical ideas. We talked about a lot of, like, ways to be a little bit more abstract about thinking about this stuff. Although, you know, I would also say this was abstract, but I think it was very clear. The more I think about it, the more it helps kind of create a sense of clarity and giving me a sort of like a guideline to go back to and reflect on when I'm thinking about tabling at future shows. But, you know, I'm interested in learning more about this UI UX stuff and finding the parallels between, you know, selling a comic and creating a service on a site. And, you know, also just the sake of making my site better, which we've talked about in past episodes. So I'm wondering what would be a go-to resource that you would point us at?
Let's see. I think what we were addressing mostly so far, not entirely. We were tapping on a little bit of some practical actions or things you can do, but obviously we'll ramp into more of that now. But we were hitting a really important aspect, which is the planning and capturing that intent and relating that intent in some kind of model, right? Which is, oh, who are you trying to reach? How is this whole thing going to work? And have some kind of map for it that makes sense for you. Like, maybe Ada works for you, maybe something else works for you. But that's a way to, that's pretty tangible. So you'd make a sketch. I mean, even doing a whiteboard of this, saying, oh, I want to, you know, have these people see this thing and, get them to make a choice about it, but in this way, and that planning stuff. Anyway, I think that part does serve a lot of value, that you don't have to get into like the detailed UX discipline-y things, but like, because here be dragons. And I love this kind of thinking and these kinds of tools, but you can get lost in a sea of data, not necessary. And that plan is always going to be the guide to pull you out of overanalyzing the stuff.
Yeah.
Like in some ways you can connect a measurement thing to what you're doing pretty easily. You can get an account at Google Analytics or a similar provider. Your web logs, depending on how your site is hosted, you may have access to, what have you. And you can get a whole bunch of interesting data that, even as it stands, serves an interesting purpose, and you can start to bolster it and go deeper. But even all that, it's helpful, but it's and we can I'll give more tangible examples, but I'm just trying to give a big caveat here where, like, it's worth not getting lost in that, because, you know, keeping your eyes on the prize of, like, what exactly is the end result? And is that, if that one's moving along and you're too busy making cool comics and those shirts or whatever you're making are going out the door, yeah, take a look at these other data elements. But I think you're, that way you have a radar to detect, holy moly, we could do more conversion even though we're already making enough sales, right? So that's right. Like,
I could see like going down a rabbit hole where you're doing like A/B testing, where I'm going to have two different covers. This one's going to have a little bit more orange on it, and then I'm going to put a custom URL on the back of that one and a custom URL on the back of the other one. So not only am I testing like the sales, mm-hmm. based on how many I have left at the end, but then I can test out upon purchasing how many of the people who bought the orangish cover visited the URL versus how many people who bought the blue cover visited the URL. Yeah, you can easily create, you know, a sea of data that doesn't necessarily help you in the long run.
Well, and here you go, where so if your goal is to both make that sale, and you have sort of this ongoing interest to say, you know what, I'm growing an audience, so I want people to come sign up, so I've got a URL on my comic, and to entice people to actually go through this process all over again, right, to get their attention and get their interest and make them decide and have so they act on something, you got to do it all over again every time you're interacting with them, right?
Yeah.
And it's just that it's less difficult. This is where the principle of, well, it's easier to sell to your existing audience than a new one, because they already have some level of familiarity and trust with you.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you mentioned essentially tagging merchandise. That's cool. Nice approach. You know, things like Webkinz and all that. There's toys that use this approach. I think... oh gosh, what is it? Sky Raiders? I haven't had a chance to check those out, but it's essentially like some action figures that interact with some games and whatnot. Like a way better version of Captain Power.
Interesting.
So,
I'm looking on Wikipedia right now. Sky Raiders, a new type of fighter plane with a bomb sight. Nazi agent Felix Lynx attempts to steal these inventions for his own country.
Sky,
what it is. Universal Film Serial is what I'm looking at.
Oh, man. I may be calling the wrong name out. Feel free to ping us in the chat or whatever if you have the right name.
I remember also seeing a line of dinosaur toys. They were combat dinosaurs that had different armor, and they had a DNA gun. Like it was like a plastic syringe on like a gun kind of configuration. You jam the thing into their back, and then you could like inject them with their special DNA, and then they could come apart. You could reconfigure them in different ways. And then they also had a USB port, so you could plug them into your PC, and then the virtual version of your dinosaur would be reconfigured in the way that you've reconfigured your dinosaur, and you could battle other kids online. And I saw it at like a Pier 1 or something like that, or like 2 in the morning. Like, it was in some, one of those like discount, you know, secondhand kind of places. And I was like, why didn't this toy become a huge hit? Because that is genius. I would have gone crazy for this thing when I was 8 years old. But yeah.
Exactly. So there's lots of examples of that kind of thing going on. And you can totally take advantage of that kind of thing if you're doing a lot of handcrafting of your work. And, you know, you have handcrafting control over your web presence, and you have handcrafting control over your product. You could easily do that sort of tagging your merchandise. But, of course, in order to really gain anything out of that and not just go through all the effort and not see a benefit, you'll need to think about again about that conversion funnel.
Yep.
And then jumping to A-B testing. So A-B testing is essentially it's a race. It's a contest between two versions of something you did. You'll have the version you already have and like the modified or improved version where you're trying to test out, you know what, if we made this button bigger and added more white space around the item in question, I bet we'd, you know, not confuse people as much and we'll get them to click the button or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And you could test out those theories by saying, oh, okay, and Google actually has a, they just renamed it in the recent months. But they have A-B testing is essentially built into Google Analytics now as a thing that you can opt into. And what you end up doing is when someone clicks a button to go to that conceptual, because A and B are actually the same. They're serving the same purpose or goal in your site. You're not actually testing like your blog versus your comic, right? You're not testing your about page versus your store. You're testing two different versions of your store or two different versions of a product page or two different versions of a comic page and seeing what kind of results happen one version versus the next. And what you do is that link will be a pass-through. And so one part of the population will be the control and the other part will be the test participants, right? That's the subjects and the rats in your maze.
Yep.
both will work to do what you set out to have it do, but then you get to see the results from the different tests. Another example of this actually is Project Wonderful lets you do some essentially A-B testing on banner rotation to see how one performs over the other. Another good example, if you're trying to drive traffic, because if you step back out of that conversion funnel and that whole thing assumes that you have someone, they've arrived. Well, you have to get them to arrive. Yep. Also. So then you have to do some reach.
And that's, awareness. And you're talking about specific web technologies, and what I think is for the person who's going like, what's this got to do with tabling? I think what it's got to do with tabling is that the approach, the idea behind it is what you should be trying. So like, for instance, one of the things we talked about in the comics are great was like testing out standing close to the table versus standing far away from the table, sitting down, standing up, making eye contact, not making eye contact. All these different things can be tested out with once they're at the table. To see what you looked at, you had a point.
Oh yeah, well, not only so that's one aspect of so what you're describing is as the person in the customer service role at your table here, you know, try these different things out and see what clicks with your audience, right? Like for me, I noticed that at Kids Read Comics, it worked if I was drawing and people noticed that that's a credential thing, right? So it's like, oh, this person's an artist. They're showing their credentials. Might be curious about what I'm drawing. Then they can ask or whatnot. And I would always look up to acknowledge that I know that they're present, but I'm not pushy sales guy, right? And we'd see what would happen from there. And so I'm working on my conversion funnel and exploring what works with that audience, because some shows I've found drawing just is like repellent. People are like, don't mess with that. Like, don't bump the table. Yeah. They're worried about something. So I stopped drawing in those tabling situations.
I don't want to interrupt you. You know,
totally. Yeah. And it's like, I'm not at my house, actually. I'm in.
Right.
But whatever, it's fair enough. They're not wrong for having their culture, and that feel for that event is what it is. And so it's good to try to map into it. The other thing I think is interesting is walk away from your table and look at it from a distance and look at it up close, right? Because you were busy looking at it when you were assembling it. And here's a tip from, you know, the Tyler James workshop, which, of course, worth mentioning is Absolute Consense, where he has like way more than 50 tips for doing this. And it's a treasure trove of information. And yes, it's, you know, we sell it at Lean Into Art, but it's awesome regardless.
Right.
Anyway, getting that external perspective, seeing, you know what? I thought that this was going to be high contrast. It kind of blends in because they have blue walls, right? Ooh, I didn't realize. And then, you know, thinking on your feet and trying to respond to that, to try to repair that part of your conversion funnel, because it's not a website, but you still get traffic. And
like a website, you can adjust it on the fly. This isn't like redecorating the Bob Evans to try to get a different audience or anything like that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Adjust it in a variety of ways throughout the weekend.
Even if you have a lot of structure in your table setup, I imagine there are changeable aspects to it. Because I know, well, some people have invested in like the tube piping, where you assemble it and it goes above them, like the like Lucy on the Peanuts, right? Doctor is in.
Yeah, the doctor's in. Or no,
I guess Doctor is in is below, but whichever. She had a sign above too.
Had the big placard above her with the two poles on the sides.
Yeah, sure. Totally. And you know, anyway, or people with those cubes where they're just this big old, looks awesome, but you know they're essentially sitting inside a bunch of wire cubes. Still flexibility, even if you have all that structure.
Absolutely. So I wonder, is there any website or book that you would recommend to like learn like the basic principles of UI and UX? I know I'm putting you – I'm kind of like hitting you point blank with this. And
I'm actually trying to pull up my Kindle. Yes, there are a bunch. And I'm going to just try to vamp while I'm pulling up my Kindle and reading it. It's I mean, one of them, he's a professor at or has been a professor at MIT. There's Stephen Krug. Don't make me think. There's also
we've talked about Don't Make Me Think before on the show, I think.
Yeah, we might have mentioned that. There's 100 Things Every Designer Must Know About People. That's a recent Susan Weinshank book that I really love. I mean, it's what's funny. It's like a bunch of awesome blog articles that it comes off like, oh, I'm just going to get a bunch of bulleted list tips. Some of the points are brief. Others have, pages of information, but it's about getting into the mindset of realizing that how do people perceive things? How do you create things that align with people's natural way of learning and processing information? Susan Weinshank is like a neural scientist and UX UI designer, pretty huge person in the industry. Then one other one that I really love to mention that it's bugging me that The Design of Everyday Things by, I am embarrassed that because it's even listed in the, Storytelling to Make Your Comic UI Awesome workshop. And I'm just trying to force it. It's not coming. The Design of Everyday Things.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yep.
And they will be affiliate links, just to warn everybody up front, because you know, if you wind up buying them, we helped you find them, and it'd be a great way to thank us for doing the show. It'd be a great way to give us a pat in the back, that like a donation kind of deal. You know, and as far as feeling bad about blanking, here's an anecdote from SPX that God, I'm a tool. So I run into this guy, and I never met him before, but he introduces himself and he tells me his name. Now, I know the name for some reason, and I know I heard it recently. So given the setting I was in, I said, "Oh, you're one of the Ignatz nominees, aren't you?" And he said, "Am I?" And he looked kind of excited, like, "I got nominated for an Ignatz?" He wasn't nominated for an Ignatz. I had an email exchange with him a week or two before. And so not only did I blank on the fact that I had an email exchange with this guy, but I raised his hopes that he got nominated for Ignatz. And then after a quick little bit of research, I found out he didn't. And it was all because it's just a jumbled mess of pudding inside of this giant pink cranium. So, yeah. And then I said to him, I was like, "Well, you know what? We're always going to have this story now. We always have a point of contact to go. Like, if we ever run out of things to say to one another, we'll say, 'Hey, remember that time when you came up, you did that total social blunder jersey?'"
Dude, you owe me an Ignatz. That's what I would do.
I should have done. I should have put one in my coat as I was leaving.
Psst, here you go.
Oh, shh.
Just write Ignatz on a shard of paper.
Well, I think we got a lot of good resources in there, okay. Rob, and I think you gave some really great tips for people to try out and new ways to think about it. And then the biggest tip of all that I want to say is, if you thought this discussion was really interesting, everybody, if you thought that this was some good food for thought, you want to take it to the next level, you want to do a good job tabling at your next show, we have a resource on the Lean Into Art leanintoart.com/workshops. It's Tyler James's Absolute Consents, and its build is 50 strategies to maximize your convention experience, and I think he said double your profits. But there's more than 50 tips, and it's a resource packed workshop. I use it as a resource every time I do shows now. Just the one takeaway, I mean, the one thing that made it worth the entry fee was when he talked about the con box. Here is an awesome checklist of things to put in your con box so you are prepared to go to shows. And when I went to the American Library Association conference this past June, I had the Tyler James trademark con box in my possession, and I wound up helping out a whole bunch of the other artists at the show because they were like, "Oh, I didn't bring any tape. Don't worry, I've got it. Oh, I don't have any scissors. Don't worry, I have scissors. Anybody got any binder clips? Anybody have any binder clips? I got a whole butt ton of them because Tyler James, trademark Tyler James Co. Con Box is here to help me." So not only – this is my testimonial. Not only did it better prepare me for shows, it helped me make friends at shows.
Which that's Tyler's kind of thinking, where like literally that's also why he shares that. He's like, you will be helpful and have a chance to connect with your fellow artists as you're doing this. And there's just a ton more than that in there.
Oh yeah. All of Tyler's workshops are great, and they're all at leanintoart.com/workshops. That'd be a great way to, you know, give us a little bit of a pat in the back for putting these shows together every week and thinking as hard as we do about these topics. So, is it time to kick into takeaways? Is it time to kick into the wrapping up?
I think so. I just, it's one of those things where anytime I broach that topic of UX, there's more, and I have the, you know, like, but you know what? I think we're going to have to revisit this with other fun angles on it.
There's more meat here. And the other thing I would point people at is our thinking about design series that we did a while back. Mm-hmm. There's tons of stuff in there that I think would be really good food for thought for. And I'm going to go back and revisit them. And I never go back and listen to my own shows. But this one I am, because I want to think really hard about the design of my table, how that affects people. My brain is working overtime on that now. So with that said, it's time to tumble into the closing segment where we do our takeaways and then also kind of close out with some news that's going on in our lives. So I'm going to do my takeaway really fast because we're already, you know, kind of over time. But
sure.
If you have any – even if you don't have any special dietary concerns, it's a really good idea to bring your own food to conventions. You know, I don't eat the animals, and that makes it hard sometimes traveling. But you know, when you go to a town like Washington, D.C., you have plenty of dining options. And Ann and I thought ahead this year and said, like, well, let's just like go grocery shopping and bring like a whole bunch of stuff that we know we can eat, stuff that won't spoil, you know, like granola bars, things like that, trail mix, things that we can keep in the car and not have to worry about refrigerating it. Well, we ran out. We ran short on stuff over the course of the weekend. And when we were driving back on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, not a lot of dining options for somebody who doesn't eat the meats, especially when you're driving at like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, right? So I made the mistake of eating at McDonald's, and I got an apple pie, thinking, "Well, this is probably safe." And then, for whatever reason, my body did not agree, and I was sick the whole rest of the way home. And I was sick into the next day. I don't know what that thing did to me, but it messed me up bad. And it was a terrible ending to the weekend to sit there, like almost crying in the car. So, travel food sucks.
That is that's a shame. I have fond childhood memories of McDonald's apple pies. You know, and also you know, good life lessons as far as the incredible amount of heat that could like melt through, you know, the earth itself if you let it hit the ground. That
It's
of
like the
that.
blood of the xenomorphs from the Alien movies, right?
Totally. Yeah. And you know, you learn that, well, this takes a different approach. Can't just gobble it.
I think when we're kids, though, we could eat like dirt and rocks and lizards and you know birds and be fine.
Exactly.
But nowadays it's like if I just eat the wrong thing, it's like, oh, indigestion, I need some Pepto. So yeah, that just made the ride home very uncomfortable. So you know, I'm saying this as a reminder to myself, pack more of my own food to take these things, because you never know when you're going to get caught on a turnpike without dining options.
That is a good idea too. I mean, I actually, when going into, even if you fly in, you have less of a chance to do the probably have less of a chance to do a grocery run. But I know when I went to Intervention last year, there was a Whole Foods not that far away, and I was able to you know, hoof it and you know, cart in a fair amount of groceries, even though I didn't drive. So that was very helpful.
Yep, that's one of the first things I do when I hit a city too, is okay, is there a Trader Joe's or is there a Whole Foods or someplace where they're gonna have stuff where I, you know, where they're gonna have gluten-free stuff or whatever, you know, like where they're actually gonna have something that, you know, when you go into a Walmart, they're gonna be like, what? So
Well,
you have a takeaway.
I
A thing
do.
happened.
Yeah, so I actually accomplished selling my mod book. And actually, I did get a whole bunch of you know, editorial help from my wife with, you know, refining the article and all that kind of stuff. And she went through a few of the learning curve bumps with, like, she tried to do some selling on eBay, and then there was essentially like, if you put anything on eBay that has Apple and implies that it's a laptop or a MacBook, something or other, it turns out that that's a very attractive target for people to have a story for you and a reason why they're not going to pay you in this actual appropriate manner. And, you know,
Oh
anyway,
no.
boy,
So
was that.
it's like saying iPad on Twitter and then the spam bots come out in force.
Yes, they do. And yeah, and so it's so after getting a few lumps via a Craigslist approach and then via eBay, learn some hard lessons as far as you know, how to list it with a trick there, like a stupid helpy tip, is to make sure you know you're listing something and asking for the immediate payment option, which I couldn't even describe. Speaking of UI, I couldn't recount that path. That was a blurry, like dodging blades and angry animals in the jungle path between totally didn't work and then it worked. But anyway, it's in the settings. Good luck. You know what? They can write that documentation. I let you know that the path exists through the jungle. There's that that I wanted to mention. And so now I'm sitting on my, you know, my funds from selling it. And I'm, you know, considering following up on the, you know, on our conversation from a few weeks back about the Galaxy Note 10.1. But I'm finding myself not jumping, right? And I'm like, why haven't I jumped? I was totally planning to do this. And I find that, I don't know if this happens to you, but like, it occurred to me on preparing for the podcast, I'm like, this reminds me of the marshmallow experiment. You ever hear of the marshmallow experiment?
It's kind of I've heard this before. You probably told me this before, but my brain is mush. So
it's like a famous, let's see, like a behavioral psychology study done done ages ago by Walter Mischel of Stanford. And I'm totally looking at the Wikipedia page here, cheating. I mean, I could tell you the rough anecdote pretty quick, but like the gist of it is that they had a population of young kids, and they were trying to determine the kids' success related to how well they were doing in other matters in life, essentially, and I'm oversummarizing, whether or not they chose to how they behaved in this test. And it was, okay, there's a marshmallow here. I'm gonna set it down, and if you wait 15 seconds before eating that, I'll give you two marshmallows. No, 15 minutes. I'm sorry. And so, wow, these kids would do all sorts of things to either – that range from either, boom, what marshmallow, right? Ate it. Ranging from what marshmallow to just wringing their hands and turning away and not looking at the marshmallow and, you know, having a heck of a time. But like finding ways where they could cope with this. And it's all about – it's essentially a study in was it deferred gratification or delayed gratification? And like one of the descriptions of the kids that I love is that I'm going to read this. Michel is observed as some would cover their eyes with their hands or turn around so they can't see the tray. Others start kicking the desk or tug their pigtails or stroke the marshmallow as if it were a tiny stuffed animal. Oh my God, these poor kids. I love you, marshmallow. So for me, I visit the Galaxy Note Amazon page, and I stroke that marshmallow, and I'm not eating the marshmallow yet.
Is it a situation where you're waiting for something better to come along? Like, oh, if I pull the trigger on this, then the next day this will come out, and then
it's. Nah, I mean, I feel like it's a really safe path, and that's we're always dealing with, you know, fighting yesterday's battle. Once you grab technology, that something new is going to come along. Yeah. Absolutely, right? I mean, but what would I get out of it right now? And I think at the moment I'm petting the marshmallow because, I've been so insanely busy with day job and other projects and ramping up for the teaching thing. MCAD Fair School thing. So it makes it easier. It's like, I know that essentially I would gobble this marshmallow and I would not be appreciating it.
Ah, good point. Very good point. You know, I mean, yeah, you want to get it when you have the time to actually live with it for a little bit. Right.
And there's been plenty of times where I haven't waited with, especially with like video game releases. And they'll sit on my shelf for ages and ages.
That's the worst.
Yep. So.
But.
So I do think it's not innate. You can learn the whole, you know, deferred gratification thing. Not that I'm trying to, you know, psychoanalyze everybody. I think it's funny. Like, I really expected to jump. Like, woohoo, it's done. Time to go. Nope.
I've been continuing to play with that layer paint application, mm-hmm. the Android app for the Galaxy Note 10.1, and it's still blowing my mind. It's so good. It's a very, very robust drawing application. I'm really happy with it.
It's a delicious marshmallow, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm savoring it. It's so good. And then there's like a semi-delicious marshmallow in the form of a application called Papyrus, which draws a vector. And that's very exciting, doing
Oh,
vector lines. But
I love drawing vector on the iPad too, so.
the only problem is it's not meant to be a drawing application. It's meant as a note-taking app. It's meant to be like, oh, you're going to use this way you sketch or something, right? So it doesn't allow, at least as far as I've seen so far, I can't import images into it. And if I could import pencils and then ink them vector, oh, that'd be the best.
Oh,
But
man.
I actually, this is one of those rare instances, the second time I've ever done this, where I emailed the developer to say, hey, I know you didn't develop it for this, but I'm speaking as a guy who wants it for that. If you were to do this, you could market it to all my people, you know? And then I even said, like, I have X amount of followers on these different social networks. I would be glad to scream from the rooftops about it if you do this.
Please.
Please do it,
That's
please.
cool. I mean, honestly, what a great thing to hear as an indie developer. I mean, I know I would welcome that kind of thing.
The other time I did it was for a an audio recording app
I'm
where
not
I
saying from
love.
you, by the way, Jersey. I'm saying like someone who's like, oh, wow, look at this, thing. I wish it had blank in it, guitar fretter or what have you.
No, I
Totally.
knew that's what you meant. Yeah, and I mean,
Exactly.
as indie cartoonists, that's what we want as well. We want people to say, "This is what I got out of it. I'm glad I did it." Boy, if only. Or, do you think someday you might do X? And in the case of that recording app, it was Hindenburg Mobile, which I used to record a ton of Thunder Punch dailies on. And the moment I got it, I was like, "This thing is amazing. It solves so many problems for mobile recording. If it only did this one more thing, it'd be perfect." So I emailed the developer and I said, I love this app. I love what you've done with this. This the way that this works is terrific. Do you think you could do this one thing? And I think a month later, the guy emailed me and says, asking you shall receive. And then the next update rolled out and had that feature. I was like, yay, I win.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was super cool. People should email developers of applications that they enjoy. I mean, especially ones that you spend a lot of time with.
Exactly. Well, connect with the creators, basically. Connect with the creators. We don't live in the whole towers, situation above us. You can't tell the towers from the flowers.
All right. So, with that said, we got to get to our closing bits. We're
All
going to be
right.
some different places this fall. You, my friend, are going to be at Fall Con October 6th.
Yes. And
Have
I'm
you?
super stoked. Yeah, that's confirmed. I'm going to be there. Can't wait. That's a local event happening at the state fairgrounds. Lots of other local to the Minneapolis area comic artists will be there, and I think
Is
there's
it? I'm looking up the URL right now. It's not the Midwest
it is yes
Comic Book Association. Okay, so midwestcomicbook.com.
yep
All right. So
so
yeah, I
cool.
mean, anybody else that we know that might be there?
Oh, let's see. I have not asked Javen Ackerman of the Winchcombe, but I should. And I'm 99% sure folks like Dan Oklanowski will be there. And ooh, oh man, Ryan,
Ryan Dow
Ryan Dow, thank you.
and Diana Nock, I believe, lives in that area
Yep,
as well. I think she's gone to Fall Con in the past.
I'm fairly certain. Yeah, Diana Nock will be there and whatnot too.
Oh, talking of another guy from that area, have you met Matt Munn yet
I
of Zombie
did.
Grotto?
Matt Munn.
Of
Wait.
zombiegrotto.com. He did Zed
Yes,
Reckoning.
I think I did. I think I met him at an after party from Mix last year.
Okay.
May Mix rest in peace. But
Oh. But
there.
Matt's a cool guy. See, you got a lot of cool cartoonists in your neck of the woods.
That's true. That is absolutely true, and it's awesome to connect with them sometimes and consistently. There's some cool events too that do happen, and I just I'm an antisocial workaholic,
I know.
so there
I
you go.
know. Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm only smiling on the outside. Inside, it's all just misanthropy and a desire to work.
I have to work to
No.
keep back the monster.
I have to work to push down the feelings. No, I'm kidding.
I'm kidding too. I'm being whatever.
No,
silly.
Rob,
you know, I do. Yeah, I think a lot of us do that. That might be an interesting topic at some point. You know, the whole
pushing down the feelings.
Exactly. You make diamond feelings out of the weaker feelings by getting them compressed.
All right, that'll be next week. So, so October 6th, you're going to be at the FallCon. That's MidwestComicBook.com. I'm going to be at Detroit Fan Fair, a Detroit convention, October 26th through 28th. I'm going to be there representing Kids Read Comics. I'm going to be doing a whole fleet of workshops to promote KRC there, but I'm also going to be tabling a little bit, mostly doing sketches for kids. But if you want to come by, say hi, tell me that you like the show. That always makes me feel good. And then, as we said, our workshop pick of the week is Absolute Consense by Tyler James. That's at leanintoart.com/workshops. And then the last thing that I have to say this week, and then I promise I will leave everybody alone, is, you know, if you like the show, if this thing made you feel good, or if it made you feel like, hey, that's neat, that's an interesting thought, I'm going to chew on that a little bit, and you want to give us a pat on the back for it, but you don't have any money to pay for Tyler James's workshop, a great free thing you could do is give us a review on iTunes. You just give us a star review. It's totally anonymous. You know, you don't even have to write anything. Just decide how many stars you think the show deserves. Or give us a thumbs up on YouTube, the video that you're watching right now. Just give it a thumbs up and say, hey, other people, you should watch this too. That's a great way to you know, increase our visibility for other people who are struggling with the same things that you are doing. You will be performing a service for your fellow artists who struggle with the stuff that you do by just giving us a boost, right?
Indeed.
Don't do it for us. Do it for your fellow cartoonists.
Exactly. Help us help other people.
Yeah. Well, if you think we're helpful. If you don't think we're helpful, don't.
Yeah, it was totally. It, there you go. We're awesome at so we're this is our conversion funnel. Or get out. Either way. It's fine. Just to close the loop on that whole conversation.
You know, some people worry about turning their parents. I just turn into my grandmother. Eat or don't eat. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's all the same to me. I'm old and tired. Oh. All right. Well, this was a fun one, Rob. Thank you for rescheduling, doing this one a little later in the week, and also for dropping all the really good food for thought in terms of UI, UX design, and tabling.
Yeah, no problem, dude. You saved me by rescheduling it as well. So that is awesome. And yeah, and UI UXers out there, by all means, you know, happy to converse about you know, divergent opinions or whatnot. If I, you know, stepped on our beloved discipline too hard. So anyway.
I think you're entitled to. I mean, I've been stepping on my beloved discipline for how many years now? So, but you know, after I did that talk with Sally, it made me realize that I need to do a full episode of either Comics Are Great or maybe Lean Into Art, where we just get some other UI UX designers in here to suss this thing out, tease it out, as it were.
Ton of connections between our disciplines. UI UXers care about storytelling and visualization of information, and people who do visual storytelling absolutely want to affect people. And they, you know what? There's some chocolate peanut butter combos worth investigating here.
And we will. But that's for another time.
Yes.
Until then, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't leaners. Thanks for listening.